Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Shlom. The Nobel Prize in Physics is one of the pinnacles of modern science. Last year in 2020, the Nobel was divided between Roger Penrose, who received half the prize for his pioneering work on black holes, and the two quarters went to Reinhard Genzel and Andrea Goetz for their work on the supermassive black hole at the center of the Milky Way galaxy. Our show will look at both the physics of black holes and the historical significance of this particular prize. Later on in the show, astrophysicist Emily Levesque joins us to talk about how and why it's been rare for women to win a Nobel Prize in physics. But our first guest will explain the basic physics of general relativity and black holes that led to the prize and the profile of the work that was done to achieve it. Ka-Chun Yu is a science education specialist at the Denver Museum of Nature and Science, and he joined us from his home in Colorado. Ka-Chun Yu, welcome to Blue Dot.
Yeah, I'm really happy to be here. This is great.
Okay, so let's go back. Give us a little black holes 101. When did the concept of black holes first come about?
Well, black holes originate from Einstein's theory of general relativity. And so Einstein came up with that back in 1915. And black holes actually Martin Schwarzschild used Einstein's equations and came up with this idea of a black hole actually within about a month after Einstein published his theory. And so, you know, Einstein's field equation is notoriously difficult to solve, but Schwarzschild came up with a solution for basically a spherical object and with spherical symmetry that allows you to create a solution. And so that was the first example of a black hole, although, you know, back then it was more or less a sort of a mathematical curiosity. Because, you know, you can come up with all sorts of creative ways to manipulate the mathematics, and whether that described anything realistic or not, that was still up in the air.
Yes, and then when did it first come about that, you know, through the study of stellar evolution and stellar death, that astrophysicists finally kind of figured, you know, these objects could be really out there? When did that realization come about?
Yeah, I suspect I'm not a complete historian on astrophysics, but from my understanding, it didn't really come about till the 1960s. And this is where Roger Penrose's work really became important. And he's one of the Nobel laureates this year in physics. And as I said, you know, black holes were sort of a mathematical curiosity. And J. Robert Oppenheimer, who you know, many of your podcast listeners might even remember, was the head of the Manhattan Project. Very early on, he had even worked on black holes with a student back in the 1930s. And he was one of the first ones to realize that, you know, if he had an object, a spherical cloud of matter that was collapsing inwards towards a mathematical point, your gravitational field could be strong enough to retard or slow down the movement of light. But even then, people were somewhat skeptical because for that to exist, their mathematical model had all this mass, all this matter, in falling towards that singularity, towards that single point. And so people were arguing, well, you know, what would happen if it didn't fall exactly towards the center? You know, what if that matter, that mass, missed the center because it was slightly offset? And so there was some debate about whether their model described reality. And so people didn't start believing black holes could exist until the 1960s with Roger Penrose's work. And Penrose didn't come at this from being a physicist, because he wasn't a physicist, he was a mathematician, that was his training. And so he used the mathematical tools that he was familiar with and applied them to general relativity. And his model didn't require the collapse to be perfectly spherical. But he found that you could still have an extremely compact object, and which, you know, we now think of as a black hole. And as a result, It was off of his initial work back in 1964. That was his first paper on black holes. And that was also the place where his Penrose diagram first appeared, his this diagram of space-time that he innovated. And it was his subsequent work following that, showing the properties of black holes, and that people really understood that, well, yes, you know, this could actually describe something physical. And then it was in the 1960s that quasars started being observed, these you know, extremely luminous objects. And after much observation, people realized that they were, they lay beyond our own galaxy. So they could be many hundreds of millions or even billions of light years away. You know, one of the most famous examples early on is 3C273, these radio bright objects. And because they were so bright, and they couldn't have been powered by conventional nuclear fusion, which powered stars. And so people started reaching for more exotic objects to explain them, like black holes. And so that's when black holes really became cemented in astronomy. And then, you know, soon after that, probably they became known in popular culture as well.
Yeah. And of course, there's a few different flavors of black holes. And I'd like you to explain to our listeners the importance of this Nobel Prize in terms of the object at the center of the Milky Way galaxy. That has always fascinated me, these supermassive black holes. And they seem to be, the more we make observations, to be pretty commonplace in spiral galaxies, especially in these very radioactive, you know, active radio galaxies. Could you tell us about that work, and particularly Andrea Goetz from UCLA, and what she, what her contributions are?
You know, astronomers realized that black holes, you know, when people were working out the evolution of stars, they realized that one way to form black holes would be the collapse of a stellar mass object. So these massive stars that might be 10 times, 50 times, 60 times the mass of our sun, at the ends of their lives, they would explode in a supernova. And one of the possible end stages was a black hole. If you have enough mass at the center, nothing could stop its collapse into the singularity. And, but, you know, these black holes were relatively small, but the black holes, the black hole engines that would have to power the active galactic nuclei, these active galaxies, where we're seeing lots of emission, lots of variable emission, emission across multiple wavelengths regimes from the radio into the X-rays and so forth. Those would require really big black holes that as we learn more and more about them, you know, these were black holes that had millions, if not billions, of solar masses worth of material at their centers. And so, you know, these would be, well, they're called supermassive black holes for a reason, but they would also have very different origins than the stellar mass black holes, just because if even if you start with a stellar mass black hole today, it would be very difficult to grow it to millions of masses of our sun. But what astronomers also started to find, you know, from the 70s onward, was that as they were starting to look carefully at the rotation and the movement of stars in the centers of galaxies, they started finding evidence that black holes were everywhere, as you say. That and so wherever we looked very carefully, we saw evidence of a extremely massive object that was compact and at the centers of all galaxies that we could carefully look at. And so there's basically a consensus now that there is a supermassive black hole at the centers of pretty much every galaxy out there. And that includes our own galaxy, our Milky Way. And so we think today that there is a supermassive black hole of at least 4 million solar masses, or just above 4 million solar masses, at the center of our galaxy. And the reason we think that is by the work of Andrea Ghez and Reinhard Genzel, who led two separate independent teams starting in the 90s. They started looking at our own Milky Way really carefully, and they were the ones who found evidence for the supermassive black hole.
Yeah, one of the things that I find really kind of fascinating and just cool is that, you know, they use one of the most basic laws of physics in astronomy, Kepler's third law, to determine the mass of the supermassive black hole at the center of the galaxy, which last I saw was like just over 4 million solar masses. And I was wondering if you could just explain to our listeners, you know, as simply as possible, how do they use the third law to determine the mass of a galaxy, of a supermassive black hole at the heart of a galaxy, rather?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so Newton's laws basically describe the motions of bodies in the universe based on, you know, simple forces like gravity. You know, if you look at Newton's laws, you'll find that the greater the source of gravity, or the greater the gravitational pull of that central object that your smaller mass is orbiting around, the faster it has to move in order not to fall in. And so if you look at even in our solar system, or if you look at satellites in orbit around the Earth, they have to move at a certain speed because that allows them to fall around that central object in its orbit, as opposed to falling in, because gravity pulls inward, it pulls radially in towards the center. And so if an object wasn't moving at all, it would just fall inwards towards your central body. And so the, for example, the International Space Station in orbit around the Earth is moving at in excess of about 15,000 miles per hour around the Earth. And that allows it to continuously fall around the Earth as opposed to falling in. If it was moving slower than that, then it would start falling inwards more than it would fall around it, and then it would eventually collide with the Earth. And that's the same sort of analogy that you have to make when thinking about black holes, that if you were to measure or to observe stars at the center of our galaxy extremely carefully, and then you would have to do it in the infrared, just because there's substantial amounts of gas and dust that occlude the visible light that our eyes are attuned to. And as a result, you need to go to longer wavelengths of light, in which case the gas and dust are more transparent. And so they were observing the galactic center in the near infrared, which was a relatively new regime to observe in the 1990s. The detectors are relatively new. People were creating more high resolution detectors starting in the late 80s, and they became more and more commonplace. And so they used these new detectors to pierce through the muck of the gas and dust. And they then just imaged these ultra bright stars. There were hundreds of massive O and B stars at the galactic center. And then they followed them over the years. And so starting in the mid 1990s, both teams, one in Germany and one based in the United States, imaged the galactic center. And over time, they could basically track or trace the orbits of these stars just by sort of connecting the dots, making sure that you identified the right stars and then connecting them to trace out an orbit. And by looking at the shapes of the orbits and by roughly knowing how far the galactic center was from us, they could then estimate the speeds. And then from that, you can make arguments as to how much matter must be at that galactic center for the stars to be orbiting at the rates that we were seeing them orbit. And then after enough observations, they could really only conclude that it had to be a supermassive black hole of at least 4 million solar masses, because the point that they were orbiting was dark. There wasn't a bright center that these OMB stars were orbiting. And so it couldn't be a giant, you know, massive cluster of stars that they were orbiting. And so there were lots of constraints as to what it could be. And the consensus was that it had to be a supermassive black hole.
It's fascinating to me to think of using some relatively simple mathematics in some ways to figure out something so complicated. You know, when you talk about Kepler's third law, it's basically that the square of the time it takes to go around the object is equal to the cube, or, you know, it times itself three times for how far away it is, which is pretty simple math. But then you throw in, you're throwing also in, you know, figuring out what's the size, the diameter of this thing that they're orbiting. And that's where you get like the Schwarzschild, you know, solution to general relativity. So then you've got this really complicated math coupled in with it. So for you personally, when you heard about this news, what fired your imagination? What did you think when you first heard about this Nobel Prize?
Well, I think my first thoughts were that I wasn't actually surprised at all by it, because I was aware of their work, Andrea Ghez's and Reinhard Genzel's work. And so I knew, yeah, they had done spectacular observational astronomy over the last couple of decades, confirming the details of this black hole. And I actually wasn't, you know, I knew about Roger Penrose, and I had read some of his books, but I wasn't as familiar with his early black hole work. And so I read up on that just to learn more about it. But I already understood what Genzel and Ghez did, so that wasn't surprising. But I think, you know, the other thing that was sort of a thrill for me was just to see the confirmation of how astronomy works as a science, in the sense that you have theorists, people, you know, who take equations and models and theories, and, you know, all they need is, you know, perhaps a pad of paper and a pencil to help them figure out the universe. Or nowadays, you know, people create models and simulations on computers. So there's that aspect of theory as well. But to balance the theorists, you also have observers, observational astronomers, who have to deal with all of the complexities of observing and understanding the universe, given the fact that, you know, we are stuck on planet Earth, and we might have telescopes in orbit close to the Earth. We might be sending space probes out to other parts of our solar system. But, you know, for the most part, all of our observations come from within the solar system, and the solar system is, of course, a very tiny, tiny fraction of the known universe. So basically, we are trying to understand everything else out there just based on the photons that we receive from elsewhere in the universe. And you know, like I said earlier, observational astronomers have to deal with the muck that obscure visible starlight coming from the center of our galaxy. And there's just so many other observational effects and systematic effects that they have to deal with, that, you know, observational astronomy is very difficult. I mean, they had to spend multiple decades carefully taking their data in order to, you know, using and spearheading new observational techniques in order for them to do their work. And so I think, you know, it's a real testament to just the grit and the determination of both these teams that led to these results. So I wasn't surprised at all that, you know, they were awarded the Nobel Prize this year. I mean, it could have been other teams doing other science that did it that could have led to the prize, but it was this particular result and this particular work, and I wasn't surprised. And then one final aspect to this is that, you know, and I think it's also somewhat important, not only in astronomy, but really in all science, is that we had two independent competitive teams. And so, you know, so these teams, you know, whether it was Andrea Ghez's team at UCLA or Reinhard Genzel's team at the Max Planck Institute, they worked not only to make sure they were getting they were interested in getting the results, but they also knew that there was another competitive team out there also trying to get the results. And so you had two teams that were constantly trying to one up each other by getting the best observations as quickly as they could, and trying to write papers and make announcements about their results based on what they had. And over the years, if you follow them, you could see that if one team announced a result, the other team wasn't too far behind in announcing very similar results. And this is something that happens not only in astronomy, but all throughout science, that a big part of what drives science and scientists is competition. That, and sometimes, I don't know how well liked, this particular set of teams were, but there are, I've heard of other examples in science where, the particular teams or team leaders really despise the other team, and they made it made as much effort as they could to try and beat the other side, just because they didn't want the awards or the accolades to go to their hated rivals. And again, I don't know if that occurred with this particular set of teams, but it is something that happens in science, and it's that competitive drive that has really helped push scientists and science forward.
Well, and we're about out of time, but what I also think is very cool, she's only the fourth physicist to ever win the Nobel Prize as a woman, which is kind of ridiculous in a way. But I mean, the first one was Marie Curie, so what a fabulous list of people to be attached to.
Yes, definitely. And you could have podcasts about some of the other winners as well. I mean, they've all done amazing, fabulous work. And it's a real shame when, we, through, just how society has been structured and biases of people that are entrenched, that you kind of deny half the population of, being able to work on, scientific questions. And you're really denying, the creativity and innovation that can come from having more diverse people in your field.
Well, and I think that that's definitely changing. So in the next 100 years, I bet we'll see a lot more women and people of all kinds winning the Nobel Prize. Well, thanks, Kachun Yu, for sharing your expertise with us today, and for explaining this, a great accomplishment of these teams winning the Nobel Prize for physics, studying black holes, especially the one at the center of the Milky Way galaxy.
Yeah, thank you, Dave, for having me on.
Let's take a short break. When we return, we'll continue our look at the 2020 Nobel Prize in Physics, which went to Roger Penrose, Reinhard Genzel, and Andrea Goetz for their work on black holes. Penrose won half the prize for his pioneering work on understanding black holes through the lens of Albert Einstein's general theory of relativity, while Genzel and Goetz shared the other half for their work on the supermassive black hole at the center of our Milky Way galaxy. And we're back, and thanks for listening. Our next guest is Emily Levesque. She's an astronomer and the author of the book, The Last Stargazers. I asked her to visit with us about how and why women have been so historically underrepresented in the field of astrophysics and physics in the Nobel Prize. One of the 2020 Nobel laureates, Andrea Goetz from UCLA, did pioneering work on the supermassive black hole at the center of the Milky Way galaxy. Emily joined us from her home in Washington State. And I'd like to talk to you, Emily, about, you know, how significant is it for a woman to win the Nobel Prize in physics? Because it seems to me, you know, looking at the list, there are not a lot of Nobel Prize winners that are females.
No. So the numbers are that as of 2020, the prize has been awarded to 215 people. And there are now, with Andrea Goetz, four women who have won the Nobel Prize in physics.
Pretty sure if you put that fraction together, that's a small percentage.
It's a very small percentage. I forget the exact reference, but I think I remember somebody doing the math saying, you know, more men named so-and-so have gotten the Nobel Prize in physics than women have. So it's a it's a deceptively low number relative to the amazing contributions that women have made in physics.
Well, when you first got word of this particular Nobel Prize, because you have an interest in black holes and in astrophysics, what was your reaction?
Oh, I was so excited. It was a wonderful discovery and wonderful body of work to be recognized with the Nobel because, I mean, black holes capture everybody's imagination. When I was a little kid just getting into astronomy, I just thought black holes were the coolest even before I understood them. And Andrea Goetz and the other winners really did foundational work on helping us understand what black holes are, how they work, getting some of the most compelling observations there are to prove the existence of black holes and explore the physics of these really kind of mind-bending objects. So I thought as a choice for the Nobel, it was beautiful science. And I was, of course, delighted to see that the contribution of one of the wonderful women in physics was being recognized.
Have you ever met Andrea?
I know that we've met. Astronomy is a surprisingly small profession. So pretty much everybody has, you know, met and gotten to know each other and bumped into each other at conferences here and there. I don't know her well enough that I was able to send her personal congratulations. I have colleagues who do and colleagues who'd known her for years and were going, oh my God, Andrea, like people were just very excited.
Yeah, no, that's wonderful. But what's not so wonderful is the number of women in astrophysics that, you know, very well should have won this before. And in your book, you mentioned something I thought would be good to touch on, that when women were astronomers, they were pretty much, you know, locked out of these great observatories like Mount Palomar and Mount Wilson. And they even called their staff room or whatever, the dormitory there where they ate, the monastery. Could you comment on that real quick?
Yes. So there were two big observatories in California, Mount Wilson and Palomar, that nicknamed their lodging the monastery because women were forbidden from staying in those dormitories. Women were forbidden from working as lead observers. And these were policies that persisted into the mid-1960s. And of course, the reality of this is that there were brilliant women astronomers using these observatories and carrying out really groundbreaking observations. These policies just put extra barriers in their paths that really didn't have to be there. So as part of researching The Last Stargazers, I talked to some of the women who were the first observers at some of these telescopes or who had been among the first women observing under their own names or observing as lead observers. And they were simultaneously sharing the irritation and frustration of having to sort of push back against policies that kept them from doing their science and also just sharing with such joy the science that they got to do. So it's too bad that those barriers are in the way.
Could you tell us some of the, you know, women that you think of as the real, you know, true pioneers of astrophysics that perhaps should have won a Nobel Prize?
I mean, I think any conversation about this has to start with Vera Rubin, who was one of these first observers to observe under her own name, as I just described. She observed at the 200-inch telescope at Palomar in 1965. So Vera Rubin is famous as the person who discovered observational evidence of dark matter. And it's, you can't overstate what an immense contribution this was to astronomy. I mean, it has sparked an entire subfield of physics, of trying to explain what dark matter is, how, what it's made of, how it works. And it all started with Vera Rubin's observations. She was studying the motion of stars and gas in galaxies and noticed that the stars in the outskirts of galaxies were moving differently than we would expect them to, given how much mass we saw in the galaxy. And her observations showed this really clear evidence that there had to be some substantial amount of mass in those galaxies that didn't interact with light at all. It wasn't dark. It didn't block light. It didn't bend light as far as we could tell. It did nothing at all, except that it exerted a gravitational influence and changed how those galaxies moved. These were exquisite observations. They were very difficult observations to make. So the fact that she was able to get this data and that she presented this immense evidence showing that dark matter existed is exquisite science in its own right. And it's echoed through astronomy for decades after that. It's still one of the most pressing questions that we're studying.
Yeah. And it would, an analogy would be like in our solar system, you know, the planets closest to the sun, like Mercury, for example, and Venus move around the sun faster than, say, Mars and Jupiter do. It would be like if Saturn was moving around the sun, you know, as fast as Mercury is. It's like kind of confounds your, you know, sense of how gravity is supposed to work.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. So you've met Vera Rubin, right?
I was very lucky to get the chance to meet her at Lowell Observatory in Flagstaff at one point. Yes. She sadly passed away in 2016, and the Nobel Prize can't be awarded posthumously. And I think it is too bad that the Nobel Prize in physics is a little permanently asterisked, because it's going to forever lack recognition of the amazing work that she did and of this really crucial discovery in physics.
Are there any others that, you know, come to mind that you think, you know, certainly could have won the Nobel Prize in the field of astrophysics in particular?
Oh, definitely. One that I don't think a lot of people have heard of is a woman named Henrietta Swan Leavitt. And she was an astronomer at Harvard Observatory near the turn of the 20th century. She was a Harvard computer, yes, at the time the computers were women. And she did this really fascinating research on stars that got brighter and dimmer and brighter and dimmer at regular intervals, called Cepheid variables. And what she discovered was that Cepheid variable stars had this very interesting correlation between how fast they brightened and dimmed and how bright they were. And this discovery, she knew, was really key, because it meant that you could use these stars to study how far away they were. You could measure, say, how fast a star was brightening and dimming and say, well, it should be this bright. It's really pretty dim, so that means it must be pretty far away. She had discovered a really valuable way of measuring distances. And shortly after her discovery, Edwin Hubble actually used this phenomenon to measure the distance to the Andromeda galaxy and essentially discover that there were other galaxies beyond our own. So her research was the foundation for discovering literally the scale of our universe. And she was actually nominated. She was going to be nominated for the Nobel Prize in 1926. There was a letter sent to Harvard for her telling her of the intent to nominate her, but she had died 4 years earlier, which made her ineligible. But she would have for sure been a really landmark early woman astronomer who would be a recipient of the Nobel Prize.
Yeah. Oh, definitely. And any others?
Yes. So there's a wonderful astronomer still working today, Jocelyn Bell, who is quite famous as the person who discovered pulsars. So pulsars are these rapidly rotating, incredibly tiny and dense sort of leftover husks of dead stars. They're so extreme that they're actually supported by principles of quantum physics rather than by the normal principles of fusion that support a star like our sun. And Jocelyn Bell made the first observations discovering stars like this thanks to these pulses of radio light that they emit. So she took these observations in the 1960s and in 1967. And years later, the discovery was awarded a Nobel, and the Nobel Prize was given to her thesis advisor and another colleague, but not her. And she has since gone on to be recognized with just about every incredible career award you could possibly be awarded. She got the Special Breakthrough Prize in Fundamental Physics in 2018. So nobody questions that this was an incredible discovery. But at the time, the award was given to the men she worked with rather than to her.
Yeah, that's just not right.
No.
And she also almost discovered aliens because, you know, little green
yes.
men. Want to tell us what this the LGM story real quick?
Yes. So when she first discovered these stars, these little pulses of radio light were showing up with perfect regularity. And the timing was so precise that she and her colleagues nicknamed the source LGM, and it stood for Little Green Men. And they were mostly kidding, but it was this little nod to the fact of, wow, such a beautiful, perfect signal from deep space. Could this be a sign of intelligence from another world? And it turned out to be a sign of a really fascinating new type of star. But the LGM nickname definitely kind of went down into the storytelling of that discovery because it was a slightly clever look at where the signal could have been coming from.
Yeah, Jocelyn Bell, definitely a deserver of the Nobel Prize. How about another?
So another woman that should be mentioned when we talk about Nobel-worthy work is Margaret Burbidge. And this highlights a couple interesting things about the Nobel Prize. So Margaret Burbidge was another woman who made absolutely pioneering strides in the work that women did at observatories and the role that women played as observers. She and a few other colleagues wound up basically publishing the definitive work on, I think, a saying that we all know as when we talk about something like we're all made of star stuff, we're going back to work that was done by Margaret Burbidge and her colleagues. So she studied the chemistry of the insides of stars and published an immense paper on the composition of stars, where elements come from, the idea that light elements inside stars get processed to make heavier elements, and that stars basically give us the building blocks of the entire universe. So the research that she did was published by herself, her partner, Jeff Burbidge, William Fowler, and Fred Hoyle. And years later, William Fowler wound up winning a Nobel Prize for some of his work on this area and sort of this discipline as a whole. But Margaret Burbidge and the other co-authors did not. Her research in astronomy was certainly tremendous, and she would have been a wonderful choice to receive a Nobel Prize. But it also looks at the fact that the Nobel Prize is really only given to a maximum of three people in a discipline and in a given year. And even if the Nobel Committee had looked at Margaret and her colleagues and said, well, they are recognized deserving of a Nobel Prize for their work, they would have only been able to give it to three out of the four people. And this is becoming a real limitation of the Nobel Prize with how research works today.
Let's take a short break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with astronomer Emily Levesque on the rarity of women to win a Nobel Prize in physics, despite the fact that they've often done some of the most pioneering work in astronomy and astrophysics. 1/4 of the 2020 Nobel Prize was awarded to Andrea Goetz from UCLA for her work on the supermassive black hole at the center of the Milky Way. I'm Dave Schlom, and you are listening to Blue Dot.
So I consider a star weird if it's doing something that we can't explain. There are stars that can behave very strangely. They will fling off lots of mass or suddenly disappear without warning. And what I like about these is that they really stretch our understanding of how stars work. So if we can study sort of the weird stars, the oddballs, and find the physics that can explain how they're behaving, it gives us a better understanding of the physics of stars as a whole.
Weird is not the most scientifically specific adjective I've ever heard used, however. Do you feel any awkwardness using that kind of word?
I don't at all, because if I were to try and scientifically list off every possible thing that made a star weird, we'd be here forever.
And we're back, and thanks for listening. Let's return now to my interview with astronomer Emily Levesque as we talk about the significance of a woman, Andrea Goetz from UCLA, winning the Nobel Prize in Physics in 2020 for her work on supermassive black holes. When people think about science and scientists, they tend to think of, you know, like an Einstein or somebody like that working in a very solitary way. But that's not the way modern science works at all. Could you give us a sense of how collaborative it is? Because when you look at a scientific paper, there's a lot of names on there.
Yes. And the names that are on there are crucially important. I think people are very used to, like you said, thinking of science as being done by sort of lone heroes. They usually picture a man sort of like Einstein style with the hair, kind of sitting alone in a room and thinking. And being able to do that and being able to have exciting ideas and share them with your colleagues is an important part of science, but it's not anymore the only way or the best way for really groundbreaking science to get done. The best example that I can think of is the Nobel Prize given for the discovery of gravitational waves. And this Nobel Prize was given to Ray Weiss, Kip Thorne, and Barry Barish. And they were, all three of them, crucial members of the team that discovered gravitational waves and were wonderfully deserving of the prize. But thousands of people were on the research paper announcing the discovery of gravitational waves. And every single person on that paper had made a crucial contribution to the discovery. We discovered gravitational waves using these extremely complicated scientific observatories that take dozens and dozens of people to engineer and design and build and run and keep running. And without these huge teams of experts working, these discoveries wouldn't be possible. So a Nobel Prize recognizing three crucial team members is an excellent prize, but a recognition of the entire team and of the huge amount of work that so many people have put into the project. I mean, these are individuals who have dedicated careers to these discoveries. The type of science we're doing right now, honestly, is big enough that we need a prize that doesn't necessarily just recognize three people, but that recognizes the huge groups of heroes as a whole that make these kinds of discoveries possible.
Well, and another aspect of that, as you well know, is so much of science now is interdisciplinary. So it's very, very difficult to just say, this is for physics or chemistry. And they don't even have Nobel Prizes for, you know, geology, for example.
Right. Yeah.
So, or, you know, for planetary science. So it's just, it's kind of, it almost seems to me like the Nobel Prize has, it needs to either evolve or something else needs to take its place. But because it's called the Nobel Prize and it's, you know, announced on the news, the Nobel Prize in economics today, blah, blah, blah. You know, it's such a big deal. If you could wave your magic wand, what would you do?
I mean, I would love to see more Nobel Prizes in different areas, first of all. I know that some people get very soured on the idea of the Nobel Prize and the idea that it could be very political, or that only giving three prizes in an area somehow hurts its legitimacy. And I think it's wonderful to see scientific discovery celebrated the way it is every October when the Nobel Prizes are announced. I love that week. But I would love to see it, like you said, awarded in disciplines like geology, or physics is now a very broad category, and we've seen prizes in everything from really theoretical work on almost mathematical physics, to astrophysics, to physics that has very practical engineering applications. So I would love to see the scope of the prize expanded, and I would love to see some of the limitations taken off. So being able to recognize big teams of people. I know that there are different prizes for different things, but being able to recognize science that includes contributions from people who aren't with us anymore would really open up the type of science we could recognize. I would just love to see this sort of celebration of science expanded and made big. I mean, I wish that we could have, you know, big, beautiful award ceremonies for the award-winning scientists and scientific teams in the same way that we celebrate accomplishments in the film industry. And I would love to see the Nobels continue to be celebrated, but to grow and recognize that the way we do science is changing, and the way that scientific teams are built and the way they make their discoveries is very different than it was 100 years ago, and worth recognizing.
Yeah, definitely. I would like to go cycle back to talking about women in astronomy. And there was a story that you recounted in your book about, you know, just briefly, I'd like to touch on some of the sexism involved in the world today. And I don't know how many encounters you've had like that, where you have to wonder to yourself, is this guy, you know, does he have a problem, or what's going on here? Because you described an encounter you had with somebody in an observatory where you were the investigator, you were the person working there, and because he didn't, you know, you didn't meet his models of whatever he thought you should be. He somehow couldn't wrap his head around that. How common is that kind of thing now?
So it's unfortunately still very common. I think that the way that sexism is sort of the way that it's applied, and then the way that it's experienced in science, is, I think, different than the way a lot of people picture it. So this particular story is, I was leading observations at a telescope, and someone came in and was very confused and kept asking me, you know, who's in charge, who's the investigator, and couldn't reconcile that question with seeing me as someone who was in charge. And they never said anything directly about my gender, and never implied anything about me not seeming like I was capable of doing the job. But in the aftermath of the conversation, I remember second guessing and trying to make excuses for what their assumptions. And I think anybody who's been the victim of a stereotype will do the same thing. I remember thinking, well, maybe he just thinks I'm really young, because I was running one of the biggest telescopes in the world and I was 25. And then realized, you know, when a young man is 25 and at the helm of a huge telescope, he's seen as, you know, precocious and a genius. And I looked like somebody who didn't belong there. And trying to reconcile, you know, all the various reasons for why it might have happened with, maybe this could have been sexism. We've moved on from the days where I would have been banned from working at the observatory by being a woman, but it doesn't mean that astronomy is now a place free of sexism or free of bias. In 2017, 40% of the astronomy PhDs awarded were awarded to women. So there are many more women in astronomy, and the representation of women is much better. I think keeping women in astronomy and having women in senior positions and positions of authority is an ongoing challenge. And this goes beyond gender too. Hispanic women in 2017 were only 4% of the doctoral degrees awarded in astronomy. African American women were only 2%. So it's a thing to remember in science. I think we like to think of scientists sometimes as being immune from bias and immune from the threat of stereotyping. And it's very present in the field. And I think recognizing it and working to change it and working to fix it is absolutely the way to go. I think it's something that astronomy is becoming better about focusing on. And I hope we continue improving on that.
Well, as the father of a woman scientist, I totally agree. And I want to thank you for sharing your insights with us on this episode of Blue Dot. Thanks, Emily.
Thank you.
Thanks again to our guests, Kachun Yu from the Denver Museum of Nature and Science and astronomer Emily Levesque from the University of Washington and author of the recent book, The Last Stargazers. And now it's time for another teachable moment when, from time to time on this program, our producer Matt Fidler asks an interesting question and we see if we can answer it and educate all of us. My favorite student, Matt Fidler.
Thanks, Dave. You know, I have this question that I kind of want to clear up, and it has to do with, well, a winter activity when, you know, we're snow skiing up in the mountains or maybe hiking up in Tahoe. We're at high elevations, and even though it's colder up there, I seem to get a sunburn easier. It seems like the sun is more intense. And whenever I talk about this with people, I feel like they're always telling me, oh, it has to do because we're high in the elevation, and so we're actually closer to the sun. But I don't really buy that. Can you clear up and tell me what's going on here?
Yeah, well, I mean, technically you are closer to the sun, but it doesn't matter. It's like the orders of magnitude are so tiny that it'd be like me saying, hey, your fingernail just grew towards Los Angeles, so your fingernail's a little closer to LA. It's not appreciable. So what's really going on there is you're higher up into the Earth's atmosphere. At atmospheric pressure at sea level, there's 14.7 pounds per square inch pushing down on you all the time. So like if you've ever taken a bag of potato chips that you bought, say, in a place like the Sacramento Valley, and then you drive up into the mountains, that bag of chips suddenly mysteriously expands and is like ready to pop. That's because there's less air pressure pushing on it. If you bought the bag at altitude, like say up in the mountains, and then brought it down to sea level, you'd notice that it was looked all squished because there's more pressure there. So there's more air at lower elevations than there is at higher elevations. And air acts as a shield against ultraviolet radiation. This is also why you find telescopes on top of mountaintops.
Because you can see clearer, you're not going through as much air?
Yeah, there's less atmosphere. So like the atmosphere blocks ultraviolet light. It blocks some infrared light. But it also just, you know, it makes the seeing of the stars much more difficult. So the higher up you are, the clearer the stars are, the less turbulence there is in the atmosphere, the less the air is there between you and space. And that's why space telescopes are so important, because then you're completely out of the atmosphere. It has nothing to do with being closer to the stars or what you're looking at. It's that you're out of the atmosphere. So when you're high up in elevation, the reason you get a sunburn is there's just more ultraviolet light hitting you because there's less of the Earth's atmosphere shielding you.
All right. Well, thanks, Dave. That is an explanation that I can buy.
Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio, a service of Cap Radio in beautiful and talented Northern California. You can share this program or check out past episodes and subscribe to our podcast at mynspr.org, the NPR One app, or wherever you get your podcast groove on. Our theme music is by Matt Schiltz. Blue Dot is engineered and produced by the maestro, Matt Fidler. Our associate producer and owner of A Dog Named Rocket is Ellie Johnson. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.